Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and each week this month we're talking to Jill Lepore, American history professor at Harvard and staff writer at The New Yorker. She's worked with us to choose four moments in history that shed some light on how we got to the current political and social moment in America. So far, we've talked about the death of newspapers in 1765, the Karen Ann Quinlan right to die case of 1975, and today it's the parrot fever panic of 1930. It's a cautionary tale about how fevered media coverage and ambitious scientists can capitalize on the national hypochondria and cause a panic. Jill Lepore, welcome back to WNYC, and thanks again for doing this series with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So tell me what happened in 1930. What was parrot fever, and how bad was the panic?
Well, picture this. It's just after Black Monday, the stock exchange collapse in October of 1929, and the Christmas season, shopping season, is pretty grim. But a story comes out. It's released right after Christmas that parrots that were given to women, largely by their husbands, as Christmas presents have been making people sick. And a diagnosis is offered of psittacosis, which is a well-established disease, but that's never been seen or examined in the United States. And pretty quickly, American newspaper reporters seize upon this as a very good story to tell in difficult economic times and more or less create a national parrot fever panic.
And what did the scientists have to do with fanning the flames of parrot panic? You write about a pathologist who, in order to get funding, had to hunt and kill a microbe that was lethal and unknown. Who was this man, and what was this challenge?
This was a guy named Charles Armstrong, who was a pathologist who worked with the U.S. Public Health Service. A lot of these guys had actually served in the hygiene service or the sanitation service during the First World War, when scientists put what had been learned about the germ theory of disease, which was still relatively new. I mean, that Pasteur's theory only really dates to the 1870s. And had only become sort of, germ had only really become a household word in the 19-teens and 1920s, and especially in the wake of the influenza epidemic in 1918. These guys had kind of become heroes, men of science, the great men of progress of the 20th century, the way engineers and inventors like Edison were the men of science of the 19th century. And there's a very particular heroic model that they followed, and that was much fictionalized and the subject of a lot of pulp journalism, which was that they were conquering things that no one else could see, and they were rescuing everyone, rescuing the world from invisible enemies.
And he basically needed a panic in order to get his funding and do this research?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to question the motives of these guys. I mean, they're doing very dangerous work. As it happened, the people who suffered most from actual infection with psittacosis were the scientists who were undertaking the research, because they didn't use careful enough hygiene methods in their own laboratories. But what they were trying to do, it turns out, with this particular fever, was parlayed into federal funding for an expanded National Health Service. And the end result of the parrot fever panic of 1929-1930 was the establishment in May of 1930 of the National Institute of Health.
So before we talk about how this is related to today, there are diseases, there are epidemics, and there are stories about diseases and epidemics. How was parrot fever covered in the media in 1930?
Well, you have to remember that science reporting was also a new thing. So what was new about it was that there was a concerted effort on the part of scientists to use the media, to use newspapers and magazines to gain federal support and popular support for their own research so that they could get more money from the government. And there was also a great amount of money to be made by newspapers and magazines in selling disease, because they were selling these new hygiene products. All the things that, and remember with the swine flu panic and the sales of Purell went off the roof, and you now kind of can't go into any public building without encountering a big squirter of Purell. Well, you know, Listerine and Lysol and Kleenex were the hygiene products of the 1920s. And those were sold mainly in the pages of American magazines. And the stories that you read in those magazines, a lot of them were about diseases and how dangerous diseases were. So a savvy magazine publisher, like the publisher of Ladies' Home Journal, say, could sell each month a new disease. And the more obscure and the more fatal the disease, the better. It didn't matter if it actually never happened or no one had ever heard of it or no one was ever infected by it. If it created a panic and made advertisers pleased, it would do a very good job in expanding the circulation of those magazines. Newspapers, too, were reporting in a much more quicker pace than they ever had before. So one of the things that's interesting about parrot fever in 1929, 1930, is just how quickly, I mean, we talk now about the viral news, spread of news.
Right.
And, of course, that's instant. But by the standards of the 1920s, for a disease, you know, was first seen in Baltimore to be reported in Los Angeles the next day was quite extraordinary.
And you make the connection, obviously, to the swine flu panic in 2009, when not only did Purell become, you know, ubiquitous in office buildings. Joe Biden said that Americans should probably not ride the subway or fly on a plane. Schools closed in our area. Pharmacies ran out of surgical masks. But swine flu, though it was real, and some people definitely died from it, turned out not to be as bad as feared, just as parrot fever wasn't. So you see a parallel?
Yeah, I mean, I actually ended up writing the story because I was supposed to be getting on a plane in the weekend after Joe Biden had made those remarks. And I'm a sort of panicky person, and I couldn't really figure out what to do. I thought, okay, that sounds crazy to me that I cannot get on a plane without wearing a surgical mask. And I would go to class, you know, here at Harvard, and people would be walking around the city with their surgical masks on. I'm sure there was some of that in New York as well. And I literally did not know how to comprehend the story. It was very difficult to tell while the story was breaking whether we were really in the midst of a truly hysterical panic or whether the world was about to come to an end. I don't know if you felt that way, but I felt like I really couldn't tell. And so when I have a question like that, I really want to think about how stories work. And the story seemed very familiar. There were things about it even at the time, even as we would be reporting that people were concerned about it. Somehow swine flu seemed to come from people who were dark-skinned. And it was people who were dirty and who had dirty pigs in the street. It was this Latin American disease. And it was about poverty and dark-skinned people. I mean, there was something kind of anti-immigrationist about it. And it was kind of this swinish flu was crossing American borders. And then remember there was that kind of ruling, well, we'll call it the H1N1 or whatever it was. So that the kind of implications of the kind of the animalistic, sort of vaguely racist notions of the way the disease was referred to would be addressed. Well, I ended up reading about parrot fever, which was initially found in Argentina. And a lot of the rhetoric in American newspapers in the 1920s and 30s, also a time of very fevered anti-immigrationist sentiment, was about, you know, this invisible menace coming from the south of the border.
My guest on WNYC, historian Jill Lepore from Harvard and The New Yorker. Her most recent book, by the way, is The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History. She's joining us for 4 weeks in a row this month to talk about things from American history that seem to set up the current political and social moment. And today it's the parrot fever panic of 1930. So back to 1930. All of a sudden, publishers were selling a lot of magazines and newspapers because people are afraid of parrot fever. Panics are good for the publishing industry. Do you think the media is cynically capitalizing on the public's fear, or do you think it's genuinely hard for the media to figure out whether an outbreak will reach scary epidemic proportions and are just being, you know, prudently careful to really warn people and get their attention?
Well, I think that varies from news organization to news organization, and it also – what I would think of that would depend on how cynical I am today versus how cynical I am tomorrow. I guess I would like to think that people are trying to be as careful as possible, and of course, the best reporters and editors are thinking about their responsibility to the public. At the same time, I think that responsibility in this instance – and it's a telling irony – kind of worked against – silencing the panic, because, say, Armstrong really needed the panic in order to cure psittacosis, to come up with a serum to cure the disease. He needed a lot of research subjects. So in a way, he needed a bigger panic. He needed a bigger outbreak, in fact. So what happened when the U.S. Public Health Service started sort of announcing the existence of this disease and then sending out telegrams to hospitals and doctors across the country, that people would then send their dead parrots to Baltimore, to Bethesda, where the U.S. Public Health Service was, there were parrots that were exhumed and would be shipped off to be examined. He needed to spread the word in order to get more samples of infected organisms. But that spreading of the word spread more panic, which in the panic itself is dangerous. And I don't think at the time people understood just how dangerous a kind of disease panic can be. I think we understand that better now. I'm not sure that we take enough effective actions for it. But there still will be that tension between the need to warn people and the need to gain more information about a disease.
The maybe ironic ending of the story is that the parrot fever panic ends in the creation of the National Institutes of Health.
Yeah, well, you know, the U.S. Surgeon General had been working, lobbying Congress heavily for the establishment of a new charter for the public health service and to the founding of the National Institute of Health, which is now, in plural, the National Institutes of Health. But one of the reasons the parrot fever turned out to be so effective as a kind of propaganda piece for that argument was that Armstrong and all the other many of the other scientists at the hygienic laboratory where the disease was being investigated got very sick. Several of them died. And then Armstrong himself was saved by the serum that he had devised, which is just the kind of story about medical heroism that really sells and really sold with Congress. Not to say that the establishment of the National Institute of Health was a sinister thing. It was a very good outcome. But this story, I think, more than any other panic, really sets up the conventions of a narrative that has proved quite durable, that we see really almost invariably with each new word of each new disease.
Do you think there's kind of a permanent American national hypochondria that we're somehow more ripe for the scary medical stories which, you know, have an element of reality to them but are also incredibly overhyped and get us more afraid than the actual medical threat would warrant? Do you think there's something about America that leaves us particularly vulnerable to this?
Gosh, that's a good question. I think plenty of people around the world are awfully panicky, too. I guess I think our news organizations have a different kind of history around the creation of panic. So there might be something sort of especially poignant about our sense of panic. I think if you think about not just, say, disease panic, but financial panic, which we have seen a lot of, and which this disease panic was actually related to, and as was the swine flu panic, which came on the heels of a financial panic and an economic collapse. I think our sense of vulnerability is a quite keen one, and I'm not sure that there's an awful big place left in our daily news culture for a kind of warm-hearted cynicism. I mean, the piece I like best reporting on this parrot fever was E.B. White writing in The New Yorker, who said, you know, basically what we have as a people is a bad case of the heebie-jeebies. And there was a way in which he could do that, and he could poke fun at what had been kind of a travesty, and people had died, you know, and a lot of people would be too pious to actually poke fun at a disease that had actually taken people's lives.
Yeah, we also had journalist Seth Mnookin on the show recently. He has a book called The Panic Virus. Maybe you read it. That's a recent book, which is about how one now discredited scientist put the panic in motion about the autism vaccine connection, now discredited. It's about how fear hijacks reason, you know, and the anatomy of a panic. And despite the vast majority of the medical community discrediting the connection, many are still worried about the vaccine. So panic is hard to shake, even in the face of scientific disproof.
Yeah, and I guess I would say, I mean, I don't know what you would think about this, but I think it's probably getting harder. I mean, I think the speed of our information makes it much harder to quiet down and tamp down panic.
Because it starts so fast, which is why they call the internet, things that spread on the internet so quickly, viral. And we will leave it there with historian Jill Lepore, who will be back with us one more time for the fourth and final installment of this series on things from American history that set up the current social and political moment. Next week we'll be talking about how we used to treat debtors in this country by putting them in debtor's prison. Now people are really panicking, thinking that might come back, right? Jill, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. Brooke Gladstone next with more ideas from her new book, The Influencing Machine.